retaliation and now waiting to see what happens next between Iran and Israel.
The Israelis aren't going to sit and do nothing. They are going to take some form of action, and some of that will be diplomatic, but some of it will be military.
I'm Carolyn Buehler. Today on The World, perspectives from Israeli allies and from inside Iran after this weekend's barrage on Israel. Also ahead, when the news is grim, there's always dark humor to get you through.
You know what they say is tragedy plus time equals comedy, right? And I think Eastern Europe has its fair share of tragedy, and now that's been enough time for it to convert it to comedy, right?
A comic tells us Eastern Europe is a stand-up hotspot. Plus, indigenous fashion designers earn recognition on the runway.
We're just going to start to see indigenous designers more and more on red carpets.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Buehler. Leaders around the world are urging restraint today as Israel's war cabinet meets to consider next steps after an unprecedented attack from Iran over the weekend. Iran launched more than 300 missiles and drones toward Israel Saturday night in a barrage that might prove a turning point in regional hostilities. Israel and its allies intercepted almost all of the missiles and drones after Iran announced the attack in advance. The World's team in Jerusalem recorded these sounds before running down into a shelter on Saturday night. They then made their way to Amman, Jordan, where Marco Werman and Matthew Bell filed this dispatch.
To understand Iran's unprecedented weekend attack on Israel, we have to go back to the previous week. April 1st, that's when Israel launched an attack on Iran in Syria. What happened, Matthew?
Well, Israeli officials have not taken responsibility for that publicly, but it's widely assumed that the Israelis carried out a strike in Damascus at a building at the embassy, Iranian embassy, in the Syrian capital, and killed one senior military commander from Iranian Revolutionary Guard, along with six other personnel were also killed in that strike.
Now, Iran said it would retaliate for that attack on its consulate, and then Saturday night, warnings came out that an attack was underway. We were in Jerusalem, Matthew. Explain how events unfolded.
So there was a lot of speculation over several days about what would be coming, Israelis were talking about that. And then by the end of the week, Israeli news media was picking up on U.S. news reports that were saying an attack was imminent. Those reports were based on anonymous U.S. intelligence officials. And sure enough, 24 hours later, it started.
And by Sunday morning, Israeli defense officials confirmed that Iran had launched more than 300 drones and missiles at Israel. What was the impact?
The impact was it was sort of a stress test for the Israeli anti-missile defense system. Again, this thing has not happened before. For all these years of all the back and forth and animosity between these two countries, Israel and the Islamic Republic of Iran, there's been this shadow war for years. And what was different all of a sudden over the weekend was that it was no longer a shadow war. This was a direct attack from Iran against Israel, into Israel's airspace. The stress test, as far as the Israelis were concerned, they said it went very well, that they knocked 99% of these missiles and drones out of the sky.
A stress test for Israel. Airspace was, in fact, closed down. We were in Jerusalem when the attack was launched on Saturday night. And as we record this conversation early Monday morning, we're in Amman, Jordan. What have Jordanians been telling us about what they saw during the air attack just next door?
So again, it's unprecedented. Here in Amman, people looked up into the sky that night and they could see missiles flying across the night sky and being intercepted as well. We know that the United States military, the British military, maybe others too, and along with Israel, were involved in taking those drones and missiles down. And then finally, of course, Marco, the Jordanians were involved in this. Some of these missiles were coming down over Jordanian towns, and they were acting to help defend against this attack.
Right. It was a collaboration of Israeli Defense Forces, U.S., also British scrambled RAF jet fighters, and Jordan. Now, we were actually online at the airport getting ready to leave Israel on Saturday night when the attack seemed imminent, because we had people in line telling us that the planes that they were expecting to take them out had returned to their airports in Dubai. So we knew that airspace had closed. Something was going on. We spent the night back in Jerusalem, and we came overland to Amman, Jordan. What was remarkable about coming overland was speaking to Jordanians who were able to see some of the missile strikes in Israel from where they were in Jordan. Just a reminder of how close these countries are and how intertwined they are.
That's right. I mean, the other thing that strikes me, Marco, is that in a way this was telegraphed. We were there at the airport, and the news reporting at that moment was that there's an attack underway. These drones, dozens of drones, are on their way. It's going to take 6 or 8 hours for them to arrive into Israeli airspace. So it's kind of a bizarre moment where it was quite dramatic. I mean, this sort of an attack has not happened against Israel since 1991 with the first Gulf War. But then we had these hours to wait when people sort of knew what was coming. And then also just to see the scene at the airport, and then here in Amman, you notice that all these places are all interconnected. And it doesn't really take much disruption to see. It just kind of causes chaos through the whole system of trains and buses and airports. And things definitely have not gotten back to normal yet.
The World's Matthew Bell and Marco Werman reporting in Amman, Jordan, early this morning. The weekend's events are reverberating globally, and there are conflicting ideas on what should happen next. Ian Bremmer follows the shadow war between Israel and Iran that has burst into the open. He's the president and founder of the Eurasia Group.
I'd like to believe that we are now at least short-term in a de-escalatory phase. In other words, the Iranians have had this very, very major show of force, but they also did a lot to try to reduce the likelihood of an imminent escalatory hit back from Israel. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean, first, they let the Americans know about it in advance. This could have been so much worse if it was a surprise attack. It was not. They telegraphed it through the Turks, through the Iraqis, who in turn told the Americans, allowing the U.S. to get the CENTCOM commander to Israel, to publicly say there was an ironclad guarantee for Israeli defense, and to get the Americans and allies in position to help the Israelis defend themselves. And that's part of why almost all of the missiles and drones were shot down, and part of why you didn't have Israeli casualties. So the Israelis are aware of that. They appreciate that. And those same allies they're leaning on Israel to say, don't escalate this into a war. We don't want this to be a war. The Israelis are hearing that. But of course, you also know that this is the first time we've seen an attack like this from Iran against Israel. The relationship between the U.S. and the Israeli prime minister is fraught. And he certainly, with members of his government, if not his war cabinet, are willing to take a lot of risks to try to get the Americans involved in a war with Iran. Fortunately, the war cabinet has to make a decision together. It isn't just about what the prime minister and, say, ministers like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir want.
Right. The U.S. is publicly warning Israel to show restraint. What would Washington do if Israel does go ahead with a retaliatory strike?
Well, they won't provide direct support. If the Iranians are hit by Israel in a meaningful way against their homeland, and you see lots of Iranian soldiers and leaders in the field getting killed, well, I mean, then we've got a war. But I really don't think that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I think that the Israeli response is going to be calibrated as a reduction of these tensions. The problem is what happens between Israel and Iran over the next months and year. Because now we have a story where the Iranians aren't going to suddenly cut off their support for their proxies in the region, terrorist organizations that don't believe Israel has a right to exist. The Israelis aren't going to stop their war on the ground in Gaza. Indeed, everyone focused on Iran makes it a little easier because Netanyahu now has this big military victory. It's easier for him to push forward on Rafah. And Iran is going to continue to provide weapons and support for others in the region to hit Israel. And the Israelis will continue to target Iranian leaders as they see them outside of Iran. That's a really dangerous precedent given what just happened over the weekend.
Does Israel have anything to gain by retaliating at this point? You know, as you mentioned, the strike drew attention away from what is happening in Gaza. Israel's allies rallied around them, and Israel successfully defended itself on Saturday. So what does Israel have to gain by retaliating now?
You could argue that since Israel is by far the strongest militarily in the region, and that Iran has just showed that it's not all that capable in breaking through Israeli defenses, again, together with allies, that might not this be an opportune time to take out much more broadly the Iranian military leadership, take out Iranian nuclear capabilities, and do so at a time that the Iranian supreme leader is 84 years old. There are reports that he has advanced prostate cancer. We know about all sorts of instability inside Iran. Could this precipitate regime change in Iran? Certainly there are those in the Israeli cabinet, not the war cabinet, the cabinet, the far right in Israel, that would be urging that kind of a strike. That's the argument to be made of why Israel should do it right now. I don't happen to agree with that argument, but there are credible people that are making that argument. There's also the more political argument that Netanyahu, who is facing an ouster, a lot of pressure domestically, a lot of pressure internationally, and if he does, he's probably going to jail, that a strike against Iran that then leads to war that brings the Americans in helps to solidify Netanyahu's own rule over Israel. And that's clearly not good for Israel, but it's good for Bibi.
You mentioned that Iran really telegraphed its plans here, allowing the U.S., Israel, and others to ready to defend Israel. But others are calling this a strategic mistake by Iran because Israel sustained minimal damage. Do you think this went down as Iran was planning?
It wouldn't surprise me if Iran had hoped that more missiles would have gotten through. They were targeting only military targets. They probably felt the combination of the announcement in advance through allies and the fact that most of these missiles were going to get shot down was enough to help ensure that there wasn't going to be a significant Israeli escalation. I mean, they know that Iron Dome exists, and they know how effective it is. They know that by sending drones first, it's hours before ballistic missiles are going to hit. Everyone's going to be ready. They certainly engaged in this attack in ways that made it clear that it was not going to be very successful. It was going to be, you know, mostly something that the Israelis would be able to paint as, we defended ourselves. This wasn't a critical hit. While the Iranians would also be able to say, look at what we did against Israel. I don't think at all the Iranians were trying to have a spectacular military victory in Israel. It is, in fact, it is very clear to me that that is not what they were doing. Everything the Iranians did in preparation for this attack made it clear that this was an effort to reestablish deterrence and not to score a massive victory on the ground.
What are you looking for in the next few days and hours to see where this is all headed?
Well, I mean, we want any statements that come from within the Israeli war cabinet that help us understand the differences between those three members that have a vote. I think that's absolutely critical. And then we watch for what the Israelis do. The Israelis aren't going to sit and do nothing. They are going to take some form of action. And some of that will be diplomatic, but some of it will be military. Also wild cards, because as much as you and I are talking about Israel and Iran and right now, the reality is there are an awful lot of actors with Iranian weaponry, money, intelligence that have the ability to engage in strikes. I mean, we haven't heard anything from Nasrallah.
Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah.
But he's taken some hits from Israel over the past 24 hours. Does he react? What do we see in terms of the Houthis in the Red Sea? All of those are very interesting things to watch right now. Complicating factors.
Ian Bremmer is the president and founder of the Eurasia Group. Still ahead this hour, we'll hear reaction from inside Iran. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Dark times often lead to dark humor. For an example, we go to Germany, where Eastern European stand-up comedy is having a moment. Comics are showing audiences there that a regular dose of laughter goes a long way, as Alexa Dvorsen first reported last year from Berlin.
We got everybody here from everywhere. We're going to have a fun evening tonight. It makes it nice if you've been to a comedy show before.
That's Dragos from Romania.
Wonderful. Don't take photos. Don't take videos. Just listen. You know, practice active listening. You know that thing your parents never did with you? You do it here tonight, okay? Break the cycle.
A regular host of stand-up comedy shows like this one, he gets plenty of practice multitasking, East European style.
I was checking in at the door. I'm doing the show. While I'm doing this show, I'm finding seats for people. And at the end, I'm cleaning the toilets, okay? So this is super authentic tonight, okay?
It's a wet, windy Saturday night, but that hasn't deterred a crowd from packing this converted cruise boat anchored in the River Spree, which once formed part of the Cold War border between communist East Germany and West Berlin. Since the legacy of the former Soviet occupation is the source of so many jokes, this is a fitting location.
Make some noise if you're Eastern European in therapy. Look at that. Making therapists a lot of money now. Yeah, that's very good. Young lady, where are you from?
Russia.
Russia, that's a lot of money for therapy. Yes. Every day another reason to go to therapy. Yes. How long have you been doing therapy for?
5 years.
5 years, woo! It's a full-time job, okay. Where is your therapist from?
My current therapist also is from Russia.
From Russia?
Yeah.
That's a wise thing to do. You have to get a therapist from your own region of the world, okay? A therapist that understands your circumstances. My therapist is from Poland, and whenever I tell her stories about my childhood, she has flashbacks.
All the comedians go by first names only. One of them, Dio, is a multilingual black Bulgarian.
Nice to see you guys. Good to see so many different shades of white. Oh, wow. Literally feels like home. Cannot lie. White people, you gotta love them, man. You just have to. You you got no choice. You know?
Dio jokes that he got out of his country so fast, his Bulgarian accent couldn't keep up with him.
I am African and Bulgarian, but I fully identify African-American. Life is easier this way. I tried to say to this one girl from Chicago that I'm African Bulgarian. She just looked back at me and was like, they make those?
His childhood was terrible, Dio says. But like so many comedians, he's turned it into material.
People just randomly come up to me and be like, yo, you're a rapper, right? You can rap? Come on, bro. Give me a second. Let me learn my stereotypes first.
You know what they say is tragedy plus time equals comedy, right? And I think Eastern Europe has its fair share of tragedy, and now that's been enough time for it to convert into comedy, right?
Dragos was born in November 1989, just before the fall of the Berlin Wall. He grew up during Romania's chaotic transition from communism to democracy.
I think he has a very good understanding of social, historical, political context, which makes it very funny.
The second half gets darker and darker, okay?
He's not kidding. The next performer, a stand-up comic from Moscow, had to flee Russia when he started getting death threats for his outspoken opposition to the war in Ukraine. After months in Turkey, Dan moved to Berlin. So far, so good. Although his barber told him it takes 3 years to adjust to life in Germany.
3 years is like 10% of my life. I can't get out of that. I'm a Russian man, and Russian men don't live long. Our life expectancy is about 2 presidents.
And a short lifespan compounded by low self-esteem, because no one in Russia is raised with unconditional love, Dan jokes. It has to be earned.
You have to, like, ruin your life, then you have to recover, and then you get love. Like my cousin, when he was younger, he was sentenced to 2 years in prison for stealing something, but he behaved well, so they released him for parole a year earlier, and then he became a hero in our family. At every family gathering, they would say, Alex behaved well in prison. So they let him go. And I'm sitting next to my cousin, and nobody praises me for never going to prison.
That packs a punch in light of the scores of Russians who are in prison for condemning the war. Dan relishes the relative calm of life in Berlin.
I like when the days are similar to each other. I enjoy it so much. I've been dreaming about a week when nothing happens.
Do you miss Russia?
Sure. I miss my audience, and I'm sorry that I can't support them.
For now, he's following a centuries-old tradition of Russians reinventing their lives in a new country. For The World, this is Alexa Dvorsin in Berlin.
Australians are reeling after two mass stabbing events in Sydney in just a few days. Yesterday, a clergyman was attacked at the altar while delivering a sermon. Several members of the congregation were also stabbed when they tried to help. Their wounds are not life-threatening, and the attacker is in police custody. But it comes on the heels of a mass killing on Saturday at a popular shopping center in Sydney. The assailant stabbed 18 shoppers, killing six people before he was shot dead by police. The World, Sarah Birnbaum has more on Saturday's attack.
The sea of flowers keeps growing at this makeshift memorial outside the Bondi Junction Mall. The mall's closed, but locals are still gathering around, really just staring. And for being such a busy neighborhood in Sydney, it is eerily quiet. The names of all six victims have now been released. They include Faraz Tahir, a 30-year-old security guard who was a refugee from Pakistan. He had just started his job at Bondi Junction, and his friends say he was really hopeful about his future and having a stable career, perhaps starting a family. Also 38-year-old Ashley Good, a mom who pushed her baby into the arms of strangers, saving her daughter's life. Her friend Andrew Reed spoke to local media.
She just was a beautiful soul. She never said anything bad about anyone, and she just wanted to be a mom, and she'd been given that opportunity, and then 9 months later, it's gone, and it's, yeah, I can't.
Authorities have identified the assailant as 40-year-old Joel Couchy. His family said he had a history of mental illness. His father sobbed while apologizing for what his son did, calling him a tormented soul.
There's nothing I can say. There's nothing I can say that can take away the pain that my son has caused.
Inside the mall on Saturday, Couchy went floor by floor with a hunting knife and appeared to be targeting women, said New South Wales Police Commissioner Karen Webb.
Five of the deceased are women, and majority of victims in hospital are also women. We don't know what was operating in the mind of the offender, and that's why it's important now that detectives spend so much time interviewing those who know him, so we can get some insight into what he might have been thinking.
This mall where the attacks happened, it's not just a place where people go shopping. It's a hub for the community. There are jungle gyms for kids to play on. It's where teenagers hang out. Seniors come here for coffee. As neighbors gather in person and on social media, the one thing you keep hearing over and over again is, it could have been me. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum, Sydney.
You are listening to The World. In West Africa, the kora is an instrument with strong family ties. It was played only by men until Sona Jabarte came along.
I started studying with my father when I was around 17 years of age. And that was really the beginning of the journey in terms of taking this instrument as my profession.
That's ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. As we've been reporting, Iran's weekend attack on Israel signaled an escalation in ongoing regional tensions. What had been a shadow war fought through proxies is now out in the open. The World's Shirin Jafari reports on what the assault might signal about Iran's military capabilities and how citizens inside Iran are reacting.
On Saturday evening, Iranian state TV aired the movement the country's top military general, Sardar Hossein Salami, issued the order to attack Israel. Flanked by three other military officials and holding a phone in one hand, he calls for the strike to begin. In the following hours, military and government officials appeared on TV praising the success of the operation. Our drones and missiles were able to penetrate the seemingly impenetrable Israeli air defense system, said this military official. In fact, the drones and missiles barely got through Israel's defense systems. But the attack did show some of what Iran can do.
This was likely the largest swarm that it's ever assembled in its history and used in an offensive military operation.
Farzan Sabet is with the Geneva Graduate Institute. He says a swarm attack is when a number of drones are deployed at the same time.
And shows that it could likely do and put together similar large or even larger swarms in the future And just as importantly, launch such swarms on a repeated iterative basis.
Iran has been developing its missile and drone programs for decades. In recent years, it has been manufacturing and selling them to other countries, including Russia. Saturday's attack was the first time Iran used those weapons on Israel. Valerie Lindsay, executive director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control, says Iran got outside help.
I would say the big thing that we learned was Iran's ability to launch a coordinated attack of that size from multiple countries. The majority of the systems were launched from Iran, but a smaller number were sent from Iraq, from Syria, and from Yemen, according to the sort of reporting so far.
She says given that the drones Iran uses are relatively cheap and easy to make, it likely has more.
Because I don't think it would be rational or expected for Iran to use sort of the majority of what it has on hand in a strike like this, just knowing that the possibility of escalation and the need or the determination for future attacks, you know, that's relatively likely.
Following Iran's aerial assault, members in parliament chanted against Israel and the U.S. Some government sympathizers expressed their support on the streets. But for many Iranians, the defiant tone of the officials was a reminder of how out of touch they are with the public. Enough, a woman told Iran International, a London-based TV program. You've taken these actions for decades, and where have they gotten us, she asked, referring to Iran's animosity towards Israel and the U.S. since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Instead, she said, you should focus on improving the lives of your own people. Blogger Sayed Ahmad Moin Shirazi expressed deep concern about what he described as reckless behavior by the government. You've put the country at risk of a war for what, he asked. Other Iranians are worried about what Israel might do next. They've been stocking up on food and fuel. This video posted online shows cars lined up at a gas station. This doctor shares tips with his online viewers on how to protect their mental health in the face of the distressing news. For many people, concerns about a possible retaliation from Israel has evoked painful memories of the 8-year war between Iran and Iraq in the 1980s. Iranians often turn to dark humor in stressful situations, including this YouTuber who goes by the name Anti-Bloggers. He says, those of you who filled up your cars last night, tell me one thing. Where exactly will you go if there's a war? You think one full tank is going to get you to Beverly Hills, he asks. Some Iranians took exception to the joke, saying they've been through war before. Stocking up on food and fuel is just about all they can do for now. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Meanwhile, the war between Israel and Hamas goes on. We want to turn our attention back to that conflict and an interview we recently aired to hear the perspective of an Arab-Israeli politician. Sami Abu Shahadeh served in Israel's parliament, and he's calling on the U.S. to do more to end the fighting in Gaza. The World's Marco Werman spoke with him last week before the Iranian attack.
The Palestinians are spread all over historical Palestine, which means including the state of Israel. And I am representing this Palestinian minority. We are 20% of the population. We are Israeli citizens. When we are talking about the war, people should have in mind that those people who are passing this unbelievable crimes in Gaza by the Israeli military are our families. And it puts us in a very complicated situation of suffering daily. And another very important thing, I want everybody to know that we are against the war. We are against violence. We don't believe that there's a militaristic violent solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And we believe that there must be a historical compromise between the two people.
That's totally understandable from the historic perspective. I'm just wondering, in terms of October 7th, given what you see around you, was the military response surprising?
First of all, I am totally against starting history from the 7th of October, as if there has been no history before and no present after, without historical context. When you read it out of context, you will never be able to understand what happened.
How should this end? I mean, what should happen next? I mean, in terms of the war and getting to the next step?
In the very close future, what should happen is, first of all, to end the war, to do this deal of exchanging the prisoners. And
when you say deal exchanging the prisoners, Palestinian prisoners in exchange for hostages, explain that.
I deal with both sides as hostages, prisoners, call it, and use the word that you want, okay? Because thousands of Palestinian hostages, thousands, without trial, are being held illegally by the Israelis before the 7th of October and after the 7th of October, the numbers have raised.
That's the kind of exchange you're talking about.
I'm talking about bringing all of the hostages and the prisoners, all of them, okay? From both sides. And both leaderships must open a horizon for a better future for both sides. This situation cannot continue. Any solution built on Jewish superiority cannot continue. Both sides should acknowledge the other, the rights of the other, collective and individual rights, respect the other, and build a normal democratic regime for both sides. Now, people would ask me, in one-state solution, two-state? I don't care. If they want to have it in two-state solution, one-state solution, binational, confederation, federation, this is not the issue. The issue is that you deal with human beings, all of them as equal human beings. You have a political frame which is built on justice and equality for all, giving a better future for the children of both sides. This is what counts.
Do you see energy around that kind of movement starting to appear anywhere?
Unfortunately, in this very, very, very dark situation, I'm seeing that mainly in the Israeli society where I live, that the mentality of anger and revenge is making the vast majority in the Israeli society blind to the suffering of the Palestinians.
And so with this trend, with the current government to move even more far to the right, and you have an event like October 7th seeming to give that legitimacy, how do you change that?
The only source of hope in this complicated situation I see is international pressure being put on the Israeli government to lead to a political solution.
I wanted to ask you about the United States. The last couple of months have seen a slow buildup of pressure from the White House. And I'm just wondering, what do you think of President Biden's approach to Israel's war on Hamas?
Without the American diplomatic, political, military support, and economic support for Israel since the 7th of October, this war would have ended long, long time ago. And we wouldn't have seen this brutal crimes against children, women, and all of the people in Gaza. Lately, we are seeing a positive change. And we know that it's not an easy change in the American administration. And this is something good and brave to do. But it is not enough.
What more needs to happen?
The same administration can tell Israel to stop the war now and to lead for a political solution for both sides, Jews and Palestinians. Without that, they should know that the Israeli society has deteriorated to this crazy situation. The next step, what we are hearing from Israeli politicians, is another war on Lebanon and another war on Syria and the opening a crazy war with the Iranians. Why do we need all these wars? We want this to be the last war. We don't have to want any more wars. We want to live like any other normal human beings in the world. We want the war to be an exception in our lives.
Sami Abu Shahadeh is a Palestinian-Israeli politician. He spoke with Marco Werman last week before the Iranian attack on Israel. The kora is a large 21-stringed instrument played with both hands. Picture a mashup of a harp and a lute. Since the 13th century, the musical tradition has been passed down from father to son in select griot families in West Africa. Now, the first woman from a griot family is playing kora professionally. Her name is Sona Jobarte, and our colleague at GBH, Jeremy Siegel, spoke with her about her journey with the instrument.
So the kora is often likened to a harp in some senses. I guess you could use that reference point. It sounds a little bit like that, and the structure of the instrument is a little bit similar to that. It's a tradition which is hereditary, meaning you have to be born within the families to play this instrument along with others that belong to these particular families. So I started learning with my older brother when I was around 4 or 5 years old, so quite a while ago. However, I started studying with my father when I was around 17 years of age, and that was really the beginning of the journey in terms of taking this instrument as my profession.
What was that moment like when you knew that playing this instrument was going to be your career and the rest of your life?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say it's a moment. It's a period of time in my life when I realized that this was something that I wanted to do professionally as opposed to just something that I was doing alongside other musical adventures. But I think what was more meaningful was the acceptance from my father to teach me. I think that was really an important turning point in that journey.
Was your father always supportive of you playing this instrument, given the fact that traditionally it was not something that you would be able to do?
He actually lived and worked in Norway through my younger years. So this was actually something that I went to find him myself in Norway and studied with him there. And then we continued back in Gambia as I was going through that journey.
Historically, the kora is not something that is played professionally by women. You were a barrier breaker in taking this on as a career. Was that difficult inside of your family at all?
I had my own ways of going about that, and it's something that I was not open about until I was really ready. So my learning experience, my journey through that was not something that I shared with anyone else apart from my father and very immediate family. When I was around 26, I think, or something like that, I was the time when I really took that to another level. But I did that through holding a performance in the Gambia that was attended by most of my extended family and obviously the wider community. So that really was the beginning, I would say, of the journey that I'm now still on.
This next song we're going to perform is entitled Mama Muso. This is for my grandmother.
Were you conscious of the fact that you were breaking barriers as a kora player, being 17 years old and coming to find your father after learning from your brother, and then at 26 years old, hitting the stage and becoming and proving that you can be a professional kora player? Did it feel natural, or was it a conscious decision of I'm going to change things?
In the first instance, no, it wasn't a conscious decision for me to go about becoming a kora player because of the fact I'm a female. It was an instrument that I was very much connected to and felt a huge affinity to. I think that is very hard for people to kind of fake. So it was more of a hindrance being a female in the earlier years because of the fact that I was not able to take that journey as every other player in my family was able to. I had to go about it a different way. Later on, when I was already at a stage where I could perform on the instrument competently, that became the moment I needed to embrace the fact that I was breaking, in some ways, the tradition, and to be able to navigate that in a different way very consciously because of the implications that it had.
Sona Jobarte, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you.
Sona Jobarte is the first woman from a West African griot family to become a professional kora player. She spoke with our GBH colleague, Jeremy Siegel. The idea of Fashion Week has been replicated across the calendar and in cities around the world. And now, Fashion Week is elevating designers who haven't always been included in runway shows. Indigenous Fashion Week, that story is just ahead. You're listening to The World. You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Next month, Indigenous fashion designers from across the U.S. and Canada will be showing their work at Native Fashion Week in Santa Fe, New Mexico. These Indigenous Fashion Weeks have become part of the industry's calendar in cities across the U.S. and Canada. At Vancouver Indigenous Fashion Week last fall, everything from tribal patterns from the coast of the Northwest to urban streetwear hit the runway. Reporter Sonia Narung has this profile of the woman who founded the event.
I am backstage at Vancouver Indigenous Fashion Week, and it's a flurry of activity hours before showtime.
Are you done in there, Tegan? Maybe I'll wait. Walks.
Jolene Mitten is from the Cree First Nation, and she's in charge of the entire production. She walks into a dressing room to try on a sheer champagne-colored gown adorned with sequins and feathers.
I don't know what else to say. This is gorgeous. I'm kind of a loss for words.
Mitten got her start modeling at the age of 15 when she was scouted by an agent right here in Vancouver.
I was at a local fair, and I was in line for a free smoothie and was tapped on my shoulder.
She had her photo taken and went to a conference where she got a lot of attention. She received dozens of callbacks from agents around the world. Mitten says her Indigenous features gave her a look that made her popular in the Asian market.
My first job was to go to Taipei in Taiwan, and that's kind of the start of my career. I got into a lot of glamour and beauty commercial work, which was really, really exciting for me.
She modeled for major brands across Asia for 8 years, but eventually decided to leave it all behind.
I was just tired of being told I was too thin or too big or not pale enough. That could really make you question like your identity and who you are. And I was definitely feeling that at that age. So I decided to come back and I started working within my community. And that's where I kind of found my purpose again.
Mitten took on a mix of jobs and volunteer work to help Indigenous families. She mentored Indigenous youth through programs in Vancouver's inner city, started an all-Native basketball team, and taught young people about their culture. Mitten became like an elder sister or auntie figure for young Indigenous women who grew up in foster care. One day, she put on an Indigenous fashion show, and many of her mentees asked to join.
Because you get to wear clothing that represents who you are, I think that really drives home like their sense of self and sense of like their identity.
It gets us time to get into our shawls too. So you go.
Okay. Yeah. Alicia Hanton is a model of Cree ancestry who was separated from her mother when she was just 9 years old and put in foster care.
I met Jolene in 2015 because I was in care at the time in foster care. I just kind of like came into her arms and she took me under her wing and put me in one of my first shows.
Now she's part of Mitten's all-Indigenous modeling agency called Supernaturals.
It's definitely like brought my confidence up like times a million because I grew up like very shy, very timid person, but I also didn't grow up with much community or culture. I only knew some parts of it from my uncles and stuff of their beadwork. It just really opened my eyes to Indigenous fashion.
Today, Indigenous youth proudly sing and dance on the Fashion Week stage in downtown Vancouver. For more than 60 years, Canada banned Indigenous people from wearing their traditional regalia at cultural and spiritual ceremonies. Mitten says the government did this to take away their power.
But you can't kill our spirits. You can see it in our clothes, you can see it in our songs now that we're awake and we're alive and we're not going anywhere.
Please welcome Jolene Mitten.
When Mitten walks on stage, the crowd bursts into applause. Success did not come easily. She overcame personal loss of loved ones, health issues, and financial struggles to put on this event 4 times. People in the fashion industry are starting to take notice, and it even influenced the other Indigenous Fashion Week in Toronto. The models from Mittens Supernatural's agency have also walked runways in New York and Santa Fe. Joanna Fox is editor-in-chief of Elle magazine in Canada.
There's a lot of younger, more up-and-coming, less well-known designers that you get to see at Vancouver Indigenous Fashion Week. We're just going to start to see Indigenous designers more and more on red carpets.
Fox says Indigenous designers are adding something new to the fashion world.
The clothing is beautiful. It's well made. It's more consciously made in the sense that it's more sustainable, this type of clothing.
Maynard Johnny Jr. is an Indigenous artist and cultural advisor for Fashion Week. He says he's inspired by what Mitten has been able to accomplish.
She is a mountain mover. She always has visions and she's dedicated to make those come true. A matriarch is someone who works for the people, who keeps the culture alive. In my opinion, she's well on her way to be a matriarch.
Mitten is by the model side as they line up behind the runway, cheering them on and smiling. Alicia Hanton says being part of this event has been very healing for her.
Once we're backstage and we're all hair and makeup and we've got the outfit, I just feel so ready to put on the show for the designers, for the crowd, for Jolene, for the people we've lost. I just become like the best version of myself, I guess.
She begins her walk down the long runway in a packed theater, and the crowd goes wild. For the world, I'm Sonia Narang, Vancouver, Canada.
And a recap of our top story this hour. Israel's military chief said today that the country will respond to Iran's weekend attack. Meanwhile, world leaders are trying to calm the open hostilities between Iran and Israel. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak says all sides must show restraint. French President Emmanuel Macron said Paris will try to convince Israel that we must not respond by escalating. The Iranian attack on Saturday marked the first time Iran has launched a direct military assault on Israel, despite decades of hostility between the two countries. Our coverage of the conflict continues tomorrow on the show. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. Find us online anytime at theworld.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Be good to each other and join us right back here tomorrow.